podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
And welcome to this questions special episode of the FYP podcast. We just missed you too much and wanted to say hello. I'm Jack Pierce, and joining us to answer your questions are the Athletics and listener favourite Dom Fifield and Joe Walker, fresh from casting his eye over the international break in view of his excellent podcast, International Clearance. Go and check it out if you've not done so yet. Gentlemen, thank you for joining this evening. Listener might be listening in the morning or the afternoon, but it is Monday evening as we talk, and I'll start with our first question of the evening from Jack. How did everyone spend their palace-less weekends? Joe, I'll come to you first. A man who's far more outgoing than me, so I trust you've been up to all sorts of exciting things.
Well, you can call the first half of England-Brazil exciting, could you? The second half, not so much.
I thought you were going to provide a reason why you had to leave immediately after.
No. I did leave slightly before the end just to beat the traffic, just in time to just before the Endrick winner. But yeah, no Samba football on show that day. Jude Bellingham gives me hope for anything being possible in the summer, but just some familiar England problems. You know, I think left back is a Rico Lewis being drafted in for the Tuesday friendly does not surprise me at all after the Ben Chilwell display. And I don't know. I'm Palace bias. Tyrick Mitchell, if he's not getting a look in now, I presume he's probably never going to get called up again because it's so desperate down that side.
But I think Ben Chilwell's performance, and we'll bring Dom in on the conversation, maybe Ben Chilwell's performance added £10 million to Tyrick Mitchell's transfer value, Dom. Quite an interesting performance from Ben Chilwell. He did get better as the game went on, but just in terms of Bellingham, can't remember the last time I saw an England player hacked out of a game as he was on
Saturday. But you have to get used to that, isn't he? Because he's going to get that kind of treatment in the summer, playing for England at the tournament. That's definitely coming his way. I feel a bit sorry for Ben Chilwell, by the way. Just on the basis that he has been injured for most of this season and has only just come back into the Chelsea side after his latest knee problem, I think it was. And so to come straight into the game against that Brazil front line, a bit harsh, but, you know, he'll improve, I'm sure.
Yeah, it does speak to just the options there for England right now to have rushed him back, so to put him straight in.
Yeah.
Luke Shaw's fitness has kind of been an issue on and off for so long. And
then we had Ezra Konsa playing right back for most of the second half.
The state of the fullbacks come, well, just like 15 minutes in was a bit alarming. Anyway, well, it's interesting, Joe. So you saw England live in the flesh. Plans to go and see the two friendlies before the Euros, or is that be your last glimpse of them before they head off to Germany?
That'll be my last glimpse of them before the group stages. I think one of the England friendlies closer to the tournament is at St James's Park.
That's right. You are right.
So
yes.
I'm not quite keen to travel up there for that.
Understand.
There are limits. There are limits to my football fandom, I think.
And Dom, your palace this weekend?
I was working. I did the early shifts on both Saturday, Sunday. I did a live shift for the live piece for the WSL game between Manchester City and Manchester United, which I quite enjoyed as a game. I thought it was quite good fun. And then watched the Brazil match in the evening. And then yesterday, it was actually really, really quiet weekend. There wasn't a lot of new stuff to get your teeth into, really. But that's sort of typical of an international break.
Yeah. Any cultural delights you're sampling, either of you? Any box sets you've been getting into? Any TV podcast recommendations you want to make?
Well, I belatedly got into Narcos, and I'm on the third series of that, but I haven't really had an opportunity to watch much for the last few days, but I'm sure...
It's a good one.
Yeah, that was, I'm putting that down to Chris Waters, a.k.a. Clapham Grand, on Twitter, who's been banging on about Narcos. I think he's been talking about the television series and not just getting into hard drugs.
Joe, any TV, any films, anything you want to recommend? Your last cultural highlight was warmly received by listeners.
Which one was that?
Wonka.
Oh, right. Yes, yeah, yeah. I was, that's right. I was warmed by the Chalamet performance.
That's right.
Chalamet also excellent in June Part 2, by the way.
Yes, I agree with you on that.
Yes, a lot more, I imagine, a universal opinion than my praise of his Wonka performance. I have got into, as if I don't have enough sport in my life, I was recommended Drive to Survive, the Netflix Formula One docu-series, which each series chronicles a Formula One season. It's not a sport I'm very well into, but it's so, the access on it is incredible. There's, you're seeing these conversations that they would just never in a month of Sundays grant. You let even cameras get close, you know, a mile near in terms of like transfer discussions and contract talks. Really insightful, and actually has made me a lot more invested in that sport than I ever would be. So I'm weathered by bad football documentaries. I often think there's very little to learn from most of them, particularly the more recent batches that you get, because you're seeing a great team win every week. In the case of the City ones, it's often you need things to go wrong to see the good stuff. But yeah, Formula One have got it right with Drive to Survive. So if you're ever in need of something like that, a bit more juicier sports doc, I fully recommend.
Netflix did flirt with football with the World Cup one, the insight into Qatar 2022, which I started, didn't get too far into, but maybe I'll go. But maybe you've inspired me to revisit Formula One. I don't know if I can do it. But hey, if we start seeing you walking around in McLaren garb at Palace now, we'll know who you are.
Oh dear, yeah.
No admin this week, other than a final plug for our interview with the hilarious Chloe Petz, which was released at the start of the month. As I say in the episode, Chloe's star is rising, and a little bit like Michael Olise, we're making the most of her before her inevitable climb to far greater fame. Right, let's get into it. And as we often find ourselves apologising for not getting through enough questions, this break affords us the luxury of delving deeper into more of your questions. A lovely array of topics that you've put to us, and there are one or two joker questions which I'll chuck in for good measure. So let's talk Palace in relation to this international break. Some of the good news, Chris Richards is a... I think repeat CONCACAF Nations League champion. So congratulations for him. He was part of the US team that overcame Mexico last night. And Adam Wharton has been rewarded with his impressive start to his Premier League career with a call up to Lee Carsey's under 21 squad, having started the break with the under 20s. And let's not forget Daniel Muniz's corker for Colombia against Spain too. As Dan says, how much did you enjoy the Muniz screamer? He hopes that he's got one in the post to come at Selhurst like that. Quite the goal, that one. In terms of the international game you did do over the weekend, Joe, maybe a trip to the London Stadium might have been better bet.
The atmosphere looked far more enjoyable. Colombians really stood up and made themselves known in it for that fixture. I imagine Elephant and Castle was a pretty quiet place because they're all at the London Stadium. But yeah, it looked like a fun game, and for an excellent goal that they were rewarded with. I think it's their first ever victory against Spain. Not sure how many times they have played against each other, but there have been enough times already in his short spell at Palace where Muniz has threatened to, you know, score or at least create big chances for himself in a Palace shirt between now and the end of the season. It would not shock me if he scored a goal between now and the end of the season. I think it wasn't his goal in the end. It became a sort of led to a Mateta goal in the end, the Luton game. But in another world, that going round the keeper and timing it better could have easily been a goal for him. So he's going to get opportunities, and he's already pushed us a little bit further up the pitch. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's making Palace a little bit more fun as a result. And yeah, if I get to see someone like that in the flesh from him, we're very lucky.
Dom, I presume Lerma and Muniz starting for Colombia on Friday evening is the first time that two Palace players have started for a South American team in an international. Would I maybe...
Did Fumaca never play for Brazil?
Pretty sure. Walter Del Rio
and
Fernando de Ornelas. Did he ever play for Venezuela? I don't know. He's Central American, I guess. But there you go. Is that Central America? God, I've
Venezuela. No, Venezuela play in the South American World Cup qualifier. So okay, we'll.
It must be. Yeah, that's remarkable, isn't it? God, we're incredible, properly, really. Truly global now.
We are moving, guys. Okay, now the not so good news. Bloke Ocean asks us, any news on Super Sam Johnson's injury from the England cap. Dom, I'll come to you on this one, but Sammy Mockbell, I think yesterday, indicated that Sam Johnston was one of, I think, three players that had been released from the England squad. And the suggestion regarding Johnston was the injury was not feared to be a bad one, and that he was just being released back to Palace as a precaution. However, I think 12 hours later, the story somewhat changed, and there now seems to be a doubt that he's going to play for Palace again this season, hugely jeopardising his chances of going to the Euros with England come the summer.
Yeah, look, I'll be honest. I don't know the extent of the injury. It's an elbow problem, I think. I don't know how serious it is. At this time of year, it sounds very dramatic, but we do it all the time. He's ruled out for the season. Well, yeah, but he's ruled out for 6 weeks, effectively, which takes you out for the season. It would be a blow. It would be a massive blow for Sam Johnston if he doesn't see the run-in, because I suspect that means he won't be available for Gareth Southgate, even if he, you know, was to declare himself fit for the last weekend, for example, because there are others coming back into contention. I mean, not least the possibility, slight though it may be at the moment, that Nick Pope might come back for Newcastle at some stage. I know there was some talk he'd had a bit of a setback, and it might take a bit longer for him to get back into first team contention, but he will walk straight back into the Newcastle team. And moreover, if Sam Johnston's ruled out, there's an England international waiting to take his place at Palace.
Matthews.
And Dean Henderson will see that as an opportunity, definitely, given that the other contenders, I mean, you're not going to take James Trafford, bless him.
Just been dropped.
Absolutely horrendous time of it at Burnley all season, and has, as you say, just been dropped from the first team, and they've won a game in his absence. Aaron Ramsdale is not going to get any game time between now and the end of the season at Arsenal.
He's the third goalkeeper of this current squad, isn't he, Ramsdale?
Yeah. So, and the other one that people talked about was Jack Butland, who people thought at one point would be in the squad for these two games and didn't end up getting the call up, and which suggests to me that he's probably not going to be involved. Plus the fact that, this is terrible, and our Scottish followers are going to have a right go, but I suspect there's an element of outside, out of mind with Gareth Southgate when it comes to that, if he's playing up in Scotland, despite the fact that he's involved in an intriguing title race with Celtic as well. But so Dean Henderson's got a chance if Sam's out. It's weirdly, and again, I know that Dean Henderson's got quite a lot of criticism from Palace's fan base, but I mean, I like Sam Johnston a lot. I think he's brilliant. But I like Dean Henderson as much. Actually, I think he's great as well. And it's more of a problem for England than it is for Palace, as long as Dean Henderson stays fit. I wouldn't want to go into the running necessarily with Remy and sort of kids again. Joe Whitworth, I mean, I think that would probably be a bit unfair on those two. I think it's just an opportunity for Dean. If it is that serious, we'll find out. Oliver Glasner will do his press conference on Friday, presumably, and will give us an update on the fitness. But you'd assume that if he's left the England squad, that at the very, very least, he'd be incredibly doubtful for this weekend at Forest. And then beyond that, we'll have to see. And Forest, of course, are one of the clubs that wanted Sam Johnston in January.
Indeed. And Joe, just before we move off the international break, John Dodds has asked how many Palace players will be at the Euros this summer. Best guesses, please. And the reason why I wanted to ask this one is at the start of the season, I think there was probably a possibility that maybe up to five players, including some that maybe have had fainter hopes of going to the Euros of England, maybe. But I think it's quite feasible, taking into account what Dom's just said about Dean Henderson. Is it possible that Joa will be the only Palace player to go this summer? Or am I missing someone quite obvious? And if that is the case, I guess just an indication of how bad our luck and the players' luck has been with injuries this season, given that at the start of the season there would have been strong hopes for Mark Gaye, Rich Eze. Yes, it's a frustration. Michael Olise, with an outside chance, if he'd had 35-plus games of the form he's shown in glimpses this season. Yeah.
Mark would have been a certainty for me, Mark Gaye, and this injury and the timing of the injury, not quite sure the extent of it and how long he'd been out for, but the closer we get towards the end of the season, the less time he has to prove his fitness to a manager, an England manager that does have a lot of faith in him and did start him in some qualifiers before Christmas. And I think he's the best candidate outside for in an England perspective anyway. Ebbs, it just doesn't seem to, not being called up for this round of games, it doesn't leave him with much time at all. Even if he replicates the finish to this season as he did for last season, you only have essentially those warm-up fixtures, which I think the squad is pretty much picked by then, unless there is a 30-man squad and then it's shrunk down. It's not looking good, and it would require Sam Johnston to maybe win his race for fitness a little bit earlier than he probably needs to be. But again, as Don pointed out, Dean Henderson, you know, he'll have one objective. Well, playing for Palace, getting more minutes for Palace is his objective. But also, I'm sure he'll have an eye on that England spot. I sympathise with our goalkeepers and the situation that we have. You want competition, fine, but I'm always sorry for the goalkeeper of the main senior two that isn't playing, because they're evidently good enough for the level, and I think they've both come to Palace in the expectation that they would be the starting goalkeeper at some point. And so in this situation, I'm at least happy for Dean Henderson to be able to actually, I think he will play his way into Palace fans' hearts. It's been an odd start in the way he's received. He's almost been criticised by virtue of not being Sam Johnston. And I don't think that's quite fair. The money spent also comes into it and other factors. But yeah, I'd be really happy for him if he just has a really good end to the season, because he deserves a run of games and to an opportunity to show what he's capable of.
Yeah, it's a new manager for him. He hasn't started a game under Glasner yet, so it'll be an opportunity for him. Dom, just touching on Ebbs and Mark Gay, what's your kind of viewpoint in terms of those two and their chances of getting to the Euros this summer?
I think if Gay plays the last 4 or 5 games of the season for Palace, and he probably will go in because he has the faith of Gareth Southgate. I'm not sure he will play the last 4 or 5 games for Palace, but I mean, we can but hope. If Ebbs tears it up for Palace and stays fit for the rest of the season and plays like he played in that first half against Everton way back in November, then he will surely be in contention, not least because there's always one or two that drop with injury at this stage. And given the sheer amount of games that the elite clubs are playing in Europe and Premier League, and the title race, it's going to be unbelievably intense. It wouldn't surprise me if England lost a player or two in that attacking midfield positions. And it's what happens to England ahead of a major tournament, unfortunately. So he will have a chance, and that's the way he looks at it. He should look at it, and as long as he proves his own fitness in what remains of this season, then he has an opportunity potentially. I think Gareth may even, he will remember how heartbreaking it was when Ebbs did his Achilles. You know, while there was that text message waiting for him in the changing room saying you're in the England provisional squad, which ruled him out of that tournament in 2021. I imagine he's not going to do it on sentimental reasons, but the fact is that Ebbs was a part of his England setup prior to this break, and I can quite understand why he's not involved this time, when you've got like Cole Palmer doing what he's doing, Phil Foden doing what he's doing, etc. And Ebbs is only back from injury for a few weeks, and we know how long it takes him to get back into a rhythm. But that's a challenge. He's got to show what he can do in the last 10 matches of the season. The other one, which is I find quite interesting, and it's not so much about the Euros, but it might affect things in August possibly, is Michael Olise and the Olympics.
Because I
do think that, yeah, home Olympics in Paris for a player that considers himself to be French in terms of his international allegiance, that could take him out of the running for a while. And there are all manner of club versus country issues that are going to be flung up by the Olympics. And we don't know that Michael Olise will be playing for Crystal Palace at that point, but if he is, and he's suddenly off in his native France for most of August and not playing in the Premier League, will that affect his chances of getting a move in the summer as well? I don't know. It'll be really interesting to look.
Man is destined to never have a full pre-season with Crystal Palace Football Club. Fit, unfit, He just he
literally
never
will never
be
have
here.
One. He'll never have
he
one.
He will
this
never play the Saturday before the season kicks off at Selhurst Park against insert Scandinavian football club here. Like, it's just not meant to be. Joe, we've talked about Michael Olise and the pre-seasons previously, but that would typify his time at Palace. As Dom says, should he still be a Palace player by that point?
Yeah, perhaps he's playing a much longer game. He maybe doesn't like the laps around the training ground on the first day back. Maybe he's just avoided that in a perfect way, fake doctor's forms or... is there anywhere I can be? Ringing up the French FA. Is there anywhere I can be in July, August? Anywhere? But yes, if he's still a Palace player by August, I think that would be so surprised. I know a lot of our best players staying we've been surprised so often. It shouldn't be a surprise when we tire these players down for a little bit longer. But given the news that was emerging, some of these reports about Palace loans in order, you know, secured against future player sales. Just should say even more than we already know that they're the future of some of our better players, and I'd put Olise top of that list, is elsewhere very soon, and we're kind of having to, should be, and I think we are planning for life after them.
Should the Olympics be graced by Michael Olise? He won't be playing in Paris. I've just read that the football is taking place in Marseille. And I think Stade de France.
No, they're playing. I think they play the football at Parc des Princes, or some of the football at Parc des Princes.
But I think the main athletics is happening at the Stade de France, isn't it?
Yes, that's why. That's right. You can't.
And I've also just read
throwing javelins.
That's right. He's that good. He'd be fine. He's that good. I've also just read, because I wasn't quite sure what the plans were. Squads for this summer's tournament are going to be 23 rather than the 26 that we saw for Qatar. So that's quite an interesting, I guess. Reduces the prospect of those players that are maybe on the periphery of things at the moment to break their way. But anyway, as you both say, if Mark and Ebbs have good ends to the season, then they are in the shot because they are liked by the manager and he's the most important person, I guess. Okay, so let's move away from international football and let's touch on Palace, which is why listeners are here, although there obviously has been a Palace flavour up to this point. But a general question, which somewhat alludes to domestic matters, it's Ricky B asked, was that a timely international break for once? Joe, I'll come to you, and then we'll broaden out the conversation as to what Palace have been getting up to during this period of no games.
From a supporter perspective, yes, it was just nice to have a rest from the anxiety, the same frustrations that, you know, certainly by the end of the last Premier League fixture, you were thinking, yeah, do you know what, actually, let the manager have some time with these players, a little bit of a rest, or if not a rest, certainly a break without games to interrupt any plans, and can actually get his teeth into, you know, beginning to apply some of his methods maybe a bit more. The term mini pre-season was mentioned a few times, which might be a stretch given, I don't know how much you can condition players in a fitness perspective, which is a real issue for us. I don't know how much you can do that in mid-March, but, you know, if you're someone that's coming through the door as late as Oliver Glasner has, I think it's welcome for him more so than the supporters. It's an opportunity to really take a look at these players without having to think about your next fixture in 3-4 days. And there won't be many opportunities across the Premier League for managers to do what he's able to do in the last 2-3 weeks, especially now. I mean, the rearranged fixtures that have led to this break, we've got something like 3 games in 6 days. April is very congested now, and ultimately he's not going to have much time to apply anything new or really change too much in that time with those quick turnaround of games with the squad size that we have. So all the work probably has to be done in this break that we've done, and we'll soon see how effective that was.
Dom, what have the club been up to? The trip away, and then presumably maybe the players given a bit of time to be left to their own devices with the period of 3 weeks between matches?
Well, Marbella was a week, wasn't it? Pretty much. And I think that was the useful time to Oliver Glasner, getting to know the players as much as anything else. And you know, new surroundings is always sort of brushes away a few cobwebs, allows him to work a bit. Look, Joe's right. You can't suddenly build up fitness on a squad that's three quarters of the way through a season and has played 20 or 30 games in all competitions, and the fatigue that they've already got in their legs, etc. So we're not going to suddenly see a massive change, I wouldn't have thought, in terms of even the last 15-minute thing. I mean, that might, maybe mentally things will change, but physically I'm not quite sure how they can. But it would have been a useful trip. The noises were all very positive about it. A bit of a bonding session, really, isn't it? Just to try and get to know each other with the so many new members of staff overseeing the team. But beyond that, it would have been difficult for him to have implemented much at Beckenham since the start of the international break proper, because so many of his players, key players, have been absent. It would have been good for him to have spent some time, you know, working with Ebbs and working with the members of the back line that are still there and that midfield. But I mean, look, we've had Colombians off playing friendlies. We've had Chris Richards off in the other side of the world playing games. The England contingent, the under-20s / under-21s contingent as well. These guys have all been absent. Plus, he didn't have Michael Olise in Spain with him, so presumably that's still an ongoing rehab from his from the hamstring problem. So
I was just dying for him to make a surprise appearance in those videos.
Yeah, well, look,
Second, he just wasn't there, was he?
Again, we'll find out more on Friday, and you know, most of all, we'll find out on Saturday afternoon. But you'd imagine that the club is really treating that carefully, because he has got to make an impact in the last, certainly in the last 6-7 games of the season. If that's 10, brilliant. But if it's more likely to be 6 or 7, I would have thought. So he's had a small group plus the kids. But for him, it must have been useful, because you need time to adjust. He's living on his own in a new country, with working with new players, working at a new club, new employers. And he's just getting to know everything and how it all works. And it would have been useful for him to see that the lads promoted from the under-21s or from the academy who are training with the first team. He'll know a lot more about the squad he's got to work with now, even though so many have been absent on international duty for the last 2 weeks. It's got to stand them in good stead for the weekend.
It's really interesting. You sort of start to unlock this stuff about international duty, because you think Paddy McCarthy is helping out John O'Shea at Republic of Ireland.
Dean
Kiley as well. Yeah.
Dean Kiley. And then you think the players, the academy players that would probably come in and help out, are also on respective age group international duty. There's lots of Ireland under-20s, under-21 internationals. You mentioned my podcast at the start of the show, Jack. There's a whole bit in there about Palace players playing for Grenada under-20s a couple of weeks ago, and there's a strikers playing for the Slovakian youth sides in our academy, and they all go as well. So actually, some of the players that are making a step up to make up the numbers in training are probably not even that. It's not just the best of the youth. You're probably having another jump down below that. So a real mixed bag, actually. Certainly for the last week that we've. Or the week that we're in, certainly, that maybe, yeah.
The trip to Marbella was only afforded to us by Newcastle being in the cup, wasn't it?
Yeah,
because in that sense, there's that sheer fortune that could be afforded to us. Because as you say, then UEFA, FIFA's international windows appear and players have got to go. Just in terms of Africa, I presume that part of the world has not had fixtures because AFCON finished so close. Or has Jordan Ayew gone?
There was a friendly with Nigeria in which I think he scored. I think it was a penalty.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure where it was played, but there are some friendlies going on.
I hadn't read that Jordan had gone, so I wondered whether CAF region had maybe had this one off because they'd worked so hard earlier on this year outside of windows. I mean, it is a stress, and we mentioned Chris Richards. You know, I think he played last night, so presumably he's travelling back today. So it is most likely his first contact time with the squad will be Wednesday at the earliest, but more likely to be Thursday. And he's got to slot straight back in at centre-half for what is going to be a pivotal game, which we'll touch on a bit later, against Forest. And I appreciate you both kind of indicated that it's hard push for Glasner to get much out of this period. But if I can ask David Fraser's question to you both, what's the one thing you hope Glasner has addressed in the 3-week period between games? What would one area of hope maybe be for you both rather than an expectation?
Perhaps defending set pieces. Mm-hmm.
I thought there were signs of that already.
Yeah. But I'm just trying to think of stuff that you can get done in a week, 10 days.
I think even just drilling them in what he wants them to play, because he really hasn't had that many sessions where he hasn't been having to prep for a specific game coming up in a few days' time. And if that's shape, I mean, again, it's difficult these last 2 weeks because so many of those players weren't there. But in Marbella, he could have done that. Getting Ebbs into an area of the pitch where he can really influence games and not just play. I mean, I thought he did well against Luton, but it was in fits and starts, and you want him to be dominating games in the way that we know he can. So finding a way of unlocking that, and I think it's little things like that, because I don't think there's anything else he can do really, other than learning a few first names. I mean, it's that basic, isn't it?
We've not actually commented that we actually had a game. We actually, had a competitive fixture out there. It was a friendly, but a fixture against Bodo Glimt, and Palace came out 1-0 winners. My only note of that game was positive to see Ebbs with another goal. And I've just written down Will Hughes's tackle, which might be the unfriendliest tackle I've ever seen in a friendly, but maybe we'll just leave that one. If listener has seen it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. If you haven't seen it, you can probably picture it. It was pretty scathing to occur in a mid-season friendly, but I'll leave that one there, unless either of you have any comments about that particular challenge.
A cynical, but also very tired, evidently tired challenge. Will Hughes in the Marbella sun is you know, I wouldn't wish that on him.
No, tough work on Will, but hopefully, you know, in answer to your question, David, hopefully some things have been addressed, but maybe not fully. Maybe it's in kind of development. And as you say, Dom, it's time with the squad. It's time to continue implementing the new manager's way of things. And I think the fact they were able to get away in that week, even while other teams were playing competitive fixtures in the FA Cup, is a positive. So we'll look at it. Joe mentioned earlier some rearranged fixtures. Joe's alluding to West Ham, which has been moved a day back because West Ham's commitments in the Europa League, and the Newcastle game has been rearranged to occur just a few days later. So I think that's the 21st and the 24th. We are currently scheduled to go to Fulham on the 27th. So as you say, Joe, 3 games in 6 days. Hopefully results prior to that take the importance of those 3 games, because there's nothing like going into 3 games in 6 days with high intention around the place.
All three of those fixtures are ones that we should probably, if we're trying to get these, I don't know, 10, 12 points on the board that just alleviate pressure completely, those are probably quite high up the list, which is frustrating, I suppose.
You want to avoid going into May with any stress then. Yeah. Hopefully they are, in addition to successful trips to Nottingham and Bournemouth, but we'll come on to the Forest one in a moment. In fact, maybe we'll touch on the Bournemouth one, because I don't know if we'll... Speaking of, anyway, let's not mid-produce podcasts during an episode. Listener, you can be avoided of that. I'm going to chuck to you our Joker question at this point. Nothing to do with current matters, just a bit of fun. But the type of question we've not had time for over the last few months. James Jeffrey asks, which players, you nominate one, it might be helpful, which players from the 1991 season would best improve this current squad?
1991?
1991, so the season in which we finished.
That's a really good question, but I mean, the obvious answer would be the bloke who got 20 odd goals that season, because he could do with a few more goals. So, righty all the way, I think, to be honest. Someone maverick who can stretch defences, play off Jean-Philippe Mateta in the way that he used to play off Mark Bright, although, yeah, I think that combination might need a bit of work. But yeah, right, all day long.
He is the answer, I think. But Joe, any others you want to Given our vintage, whether or not right off the table straight away is a bit of an issue for the
I could wax lyrical about that season. Yeah, yeah. I witnessed it firsthand.
Let's save some summer content, please.
Yeah, 1991, I'm not so good on. 89, 90, I'm all over because there was a VHS that my dad would just be like, shut up, watch that. Just get it in you.
Dom's pulling it off his shelf right now. There you
beautiful.
Go.
Beautiful.
That's 91. That's 1991. That is the VHS from 1991.
Look at that Football League logo. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. But it could be. It could. I mean, it's of a similar vintage.
So 89, 90. It's not the exact same squad, but Eddie McGoldrick would have been very useful prior to the arrival of Munoz, but that almost issue is gone now. I think John Salako's strength out wide and crossing would be useful to any Palace striker, never mind whether it'd be Ian Wright and let's be honest, Mark Bright would be pretty damn useful in this Palace team. Although, Dom, you might be able to speak more to Mark Bright playing for Palace without Ian Wright. I don't have a lot of knowledge about
The following season, 91-92, after Wright, he got sold relatively early after the Oldham game. Brighty went on a remarkable run of goal scoring, and then, just as we thought, he's sorted this, and we're not going to miss Wright. He just forgot how to score for 15 games or 16 games, and then picked up a bit towards the end. But it was very much a really intelligent combination between the pair of them. They worked so well in tandem and had the sort of sixth sense as to where each other was going to be at any one time. It was you always had a chance with them playing up top for Palace. It was they were quite something. And Wrighty Sale. I will never get over Wrighty Sale. I will never get over turning on CFAX or when I got home from school. And page 302, and it just had Wright joins Arsenal from Palace, and it was just devastating.
That's how you found out, was it?
Yeah, genuinely was. Well, I mean, the only other way of finding out was waiting for the Croydon advertisers to rock up on a Friday.
Or
buy a national newspaper every single day, obviously. But I'll never get over that. I'll never get over that. And that, you know what? To bring it up to the modern day, it's not going to be the same because Wright meant a lot more to Palace at the time because he sort of personified their journey from a shambles in the mid-80s through to a team that finished third in the top division. But that sense of devastation you still get now, and you will still get that when Michael Olise leaves, and you will still get it when Ebbs leaves, and you still get it when Mark Gay leaves, whether that's this summer or January or next summer. It's not to the same level, but because I think we're more accepting now and we know why this is happening. But at the time, it was just like, hold on, we finished third last year and now you're joining, you're leaving. We had something good going here. What are you doing? But obviously, he was going pretty well at Arsenal as well because they were the league champions at the time.
But he walked straight back into your team right now, Dom, even after causing all that heartbreak.
He probably walked back into my team at 65 or whatever he is now, to be fair.
I'm going to chuck Jeff Thomas into the mix because, and Dom, sorry to refer to you for every part of this question, but at the end of that season is when he got his first call up for England. Is that about right?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Well, I think it may have been during the season. They went on the infamous tour of the States, didn't they, or something? I think was that summer, or was that the Australia tour? I can't remember.
Salako went to Australia and New Zealand, didn't he?
Yeah. I think Andy Gray went to that as well.
He did.
Yeah.
Well, Andy Gray's only international cap was against Poland in the following season, 91-92, and he played 45 minutes and got subbed and never got on that stage again. But Jeff was brilliant. Andy Gray was brilliant. They were another combination. They worked together, and they had everything. They had the physicality and the energy and the dynamism, and the creativity was probably a bit underrated. When Andy came back from Villa and QPR and all his travels after his first stint at Palace, he just was a better player. He was more worldly wise. He was more confident and. He just looked the part in as a midfielder, as opposed to sort of this, I don't know, as an attack-minded midfielder or second striker. And yeah, for that period, for much of 89-90 and all of 1991, that combination was as good as anything in the division, and that was at Crystal Palace. And the combined fees, I think we paid $50,000, didn't we, for Jeff, and maybe $500,000 for Andy when he came back. I mean, it was negligible, really.
Quite incredible, finishing third in the top tier of English football.
Amazing,
it's amazing. It really is. James, in answer to your question, and in light of maybe the squad depth issues we've had this season, that first 11 can all get into the Palace first team squad right now. So we'll find a mix. They can all come in, do a job. Go on, Dom.
This is a bit controversial, possibly, but I remember distinctly at the time that the fans weren't entirely happy with the way things were going that season. I mean, it was great, the results, but the football wasn't great. Oh, we don't like the football. We're not enjoying this. Finishing third in the division, for God's sake, third in the top division. It's just one of those things. I mean, I'm as guilty as this as the next man, but you never really appreciate something until it's gone. You never really appreciate how good a time that was until you get relegated at Arsenal on the final day of 1992-93. And I mean, even the following season, 91-92, which is considered like a nothing season in the history of Crystal Palace Football Club, where we didn't threaten to win a cup. We started well, petered off in the middle, had a little flurry, and then petered off again at the end. So that is the second best season Crystal Palace have ever had in their history. That up there with Pards' finishing 10th.
Was it 10th that season?
And it's just, I mean, it's just staggering, really.
Is that the season of the classic 3-2 against Wimbledon with Solanke in goal? Or is that the wrong
season? Yes, that's right. That was right at the start of the season.
Another VHS forced upon me against childhood.
I love that. That video, that 2-minute segment with, I think, Gabriel Clark speaking over it, appears on Twitter once a year on the anniversary of, and it is a hoot. 5 players sent off?
No, only 3.
3 players sent off.
Vaughan Ryan got sent off for Wimbledon.
Martin sent off?
That's worthless looking at that incident, because he absolutely takes out, I think it's Andy Clark or someone like that, running down the left. And it's the most obvious foul ever. Absolutely zero intention of getting the ball and every intention of kicking the man into the stand, and gets his marching orders and complains. And the other one was sent off for a hand. I think it might have been Terry Phelan, was it?
It was Terry Phelan.
Future Palace player.
Hey, the Nigel Martin bit takes me back, Dom, to talking through the 93-94 season with you. And by that point, Nigel Martin has perfected his whole innocent look.
He took out David Mitchell
against Millwall on the Easter Saturday game of that season. Well, that's a lovely look back. And,
Sorry.
No, it's lovely. It's exactly what this episode's all about. It's taking off the pressure of talking about the previous weekend and just talking nonsense about Palace, which is what we should do every week. I'm just going to call a break there just to kind of give Jim a chance to insert some messages from our sponsors, and we're back after the break. Welcome back to this question special of the FYP podcast. I'm joined by Joe Walker and Dom Fifield, and our next question relates to the women's team. And we talked about the women's team I think at the our last midweek episode, ahead of their trip to Sheffield United, and we talked very glowingly and very positively about their season up to that point. Well, Joe, we clearly cursed them because they lost 2-0 at Sheffield United. But I'm very pleased to see that they bounced back from that disappointing defeat and smashed Watford 3-0 at the weekend at Selhurst in front of, I think, around 4,000 fans, which is great. So it is a case of back where we were, really. So Palace, a point behind Sunderland, with a game in hand, and it could very much come down to the last day of the season, which is, of course, Palace hosting Sunderland. Location to be confirmed, but quite possibly a gunfight for the title. Palace have 4 games left to play this season. So it's nail-biting time. And we've had a couple of questions in relation to the women's team. Violent Bob asks, how exciting is it to see how well the women's team is doing? What do you think it would mean for the club as a whole to have them playing in the top tier? Dom, can I come to you on that one, just in terms of what it would mean for the women's team and the club generally if we had a team playing in the Women's Super League?
I think it would be brilliant to have that. I think the progress that the women's team have made in a relatively short period of time has been staggering. This season has been exceptional to date. However, I think it would make next season very difficult because you only have to look at the Super League, and it's really a division. I suppose you could separate it into three. If you took this season, it's been Chelsea, Man City, and Arsenal really in that top tier. Man United and Liverpool have found things a lot harder than last year, and they've sort of been dragged into the middle section of maybe three clubs. But there is you probably have to divide it into four actually, because then there's a load of lower mid table teams who are basically going nowhere, and then the bottom two are really struggling. I mean, Bristol City got 6 points all season, and well out of it, and they were a team that at the start of the season, and you talk to experts of Super League experts, women's Super League experts, they said they're going to go down because they're just not equipped for this level. And I think it just requires a level of investment that you can make, because it doesn't come onto your PSR. You're allowed to develop and spend as much money as you want in your women's team, and it doesn't affect, you know, what the finances of your, in terms of Premier League points and PSR, etc., and sanctions. But it's just whether Palace would actually have the budget to do that and to dedicate money to the women's team, and whether that would be considered. I don't know. I suppose you'd have to balance. I mean, the money we're talking is probably negligible in the grand scheme of things. Really, we're probably talking, you know, one Premier League player's wages or whatever on bringing people in and raising the standard of the whole thing. But it's such a difficult balance, and we know it's going to be a really difficult summer anyway. So it'll be interesting to see how they approach it. I think it would be brilliant if more resources could be thrown their way, if they do get into the Super League, because it's the coverage is fantastic and the exposure would be brilliant, but it will be difficult as well. It will pose its own problems.
Yeah. I mean, Joe, they've got to get there, and obviously there is a tense couple of weeks ahead for them to do that. But just as Dom says, in terms of the profile of the Women's Super League, it does go up not just one notch, but several notches in terms of the exposure for the players and the team compared to the Championship, which, as we talked about last time, is still well covered in terms of some maybe novel ways of showcasing live games on YouTube, for example. But in terms of the coverage that Sky Sports, but perhaps more importantly, on terrestrial via the BBC are showing, it would showcase Crystal Palace women's team to a whole new audience.
Absolutely. And I've noticed that Sky's approach publicly to how the WSL coverage is advertised, how it's promoted, how it's scheduled, it's been getting so much more respect from the broadcaster first, which in years previous might not have always been the case. And as such, I think there's been windows of time on a weekend. You've watched Super Sunday, and then that's then you get your extra taste of football afterwards. And I don't know how actually negatively that might actually affect the teams taking part in those games, but certainly as an audience viewer, it's been highly beneficial to be able to see the WSL get dedicated kickoff times and sort of windows to be only watched on Sky on the weekend. So the Palace team becoming part of that contingent is massive, not just for those individual players, but I think as the club and the profile, as the women's game just continues on its upwards momentum and in terms of interest, it can only be an exciting thing.
It's about building the profile of a club, isn't it? We've got a Premier League club that if we stay up this year, will have been in the division for 11 years, which is brilliant. We've got a Category 1 academy that we've poured resources into, pristine academy. We will reap the benefits of that in the years to come. Definitely fantastic. We're up there on that. The women's team is a natural next thing to attack and elevate to that level as well. And once you get that in a situation where even when the main stand is redeveloped, we're still looking at a capacity of what, 30,000, 35,000, whatever it is. If Palace are doing well, there will be more demand for tickets. And if you want to build your fan base as well, then get people coming to the women's game at Selhurst Park as well. Get them involved in that. Get them watching a Crystal Palace team out there in the afternoon. And if they're competing at the highest level in the Women's Super League, and they're playing against Man City, and they're playing against Chelsea, and they're playing against Arsenal, then that is the way to do it. Just get people through the gates, get the interest up, build it up. You're building for the future. You look at the demographic of people who go and watch women's the WSL. It's so many kids there. So the future of football are there. They're there, and it's you know, women's football definitely, but it can be men's football as well. It absolutely can, because you're hopefully these young fans are falling in love with a club, and the club encompasses everybody. So.
It's a very positive place to be. As you know, we've had another question from Juice Bailey. He asked, have you considered, it's a question for the podcast, have you considered doing a CPFC women's team post-match or a weekly roundup or similar? I'd love to get more of an insight into how they play, who the stars are, especially with the season they're having. I think what we can say is between now and the end of this season, we'll be bringing you up to date with their results. We're very, very hopeful that they'll have a very good end to the season. And then maybe looking ahead to next season, regardless of which division they're in, I think there's a duty for Palace podcasts and Palace fan base to put the focus on the women's team a little bit more. So, yeah, we will, as a podcast, hopefully shine a little bit more of a light on the women's team. For anyone interested in the women's game, and I can say this having been part of a team that's arranged an event in relation to women's football as part of my kind of work life rather than the podcast life, is I recommend two titles by Carrie Dunn, who's a very informed voice on the women's game. One is Unsuitable for Females, which talks about the journey of women's football from the Victorian era through the 1920s, when it was deemed unsuitable for females, through to the last part of the 20th century, where the game kind of re-emerged in terms of its popularity. And her follow-up, which is a title called Woman Up, which highlights the incredible positivity surrounding the game over the last few years, but the challenges that still face the game. But yeah, we will be focusing on the women's team a lot more between now and the end of the season. And fingers crossed that the results continue to go the way of this past Sunday rather than the previous Sunday. But yeah, all the best to the women's team. Joe Gorman.
It'd be good to see if Palace can match some of the attendances that we had for Selhurst Park hosted more than one women's FA Cup final, right? In recent memory, and some televised Kelly, on the BBC.
Kelly Smith there, or Arsenal rings a bell. Yeah,
I remember a Chelsea game, one of those, and you know, some decent crowds in those, and it'd be nice if we could try and get some support for Palace to reach near those levels.
There's a huge local history to do with women's football. I mean, Croydon was a leading women's club up until they kind of transitioned to becoming Charlton. Now, Hope Powell was, you know, Croydon captain and a full England international, and there was a bevy of England internationals playing at the Croydon Sports Arena down at, you know, South Norwood Country Park. The local area has a strong history associated with women's football, and yeah, we'll keep an eye on things between now and the end of the season. But turning back to the men's team, and I mean, let's continue the positivity that the women's team have garnered with a question from JCM Brown, who thinks maybe a little bit wishful thinking in this one. But hey, we're talking about next season rather than this. He asks, do you think a push for Europe next season is achievable if we're able to retain at least two of our star players, bringing in new players into the system and working on Glasnable? And if so, do you think we can maintain that? And I'll chuck in a couple of other questions just. Let's maybe look ahead to next season with the hope that we stay up and the expectation that we will have that 12th Premier League season that Dom's just kind of referred to. Mike Wicks, what does the Palace squad look like on the 1st of September? And James Whiting asks, will we ever be able to afford a striker? A genuine question. So just with all of those in mind, Dom, with the presumption that we do stay up and in light of the news that's been kind of cited by, I think, several outlets today regarding Palace negotiating a loan into the club, what are your expectations, presuming that Palace are a Premier League club going into next season?
Change. A lot of change. A summer of change. The loan stories that emerged, the MGG loan on... I don't think anything to be alarmed about. It seems to me that it's most likely Palace anticipating that they will raise money through sales this summer to spend on revamping the squad and adding to options and making the squad quality, well, squad options deeper. And to do that because they want to get cracking on that and make sure they hit the ground running as soon as the window opens, they need finances in place then, because I think there's an anticipation that not many clubs, because of PSR, not many clubs will be spending massive amounts of money on the likes of Gueye, Elise and Ezra before June 30th, which is the end of that accountancy year under the current rules. So it may be that if those guys are sold, or if one or two or three of those guys are sold, then that happens up in July or August. So Palace don't want to be in a position where they're waiting on a sale to then go out and spend the money. So it makes far more sense for them to get the loan in. I think it's standard practice almost, really. It's almost the equivalent of, slightly different because we didn't have to sell a lot of players in 2021 because they're all leaving for free transfers at the end of their contracts.
But they just walked out.
Yeah, they just went. But the reality is that the injection of cash that year came from John Textor. The injection of cash this year is going to come from sales, and that's how the model has to work. That's how the model is designed to work, and the hope is that Palace will generate enough interest in these players to allow those sales to go through in July. As I said on the Ian Wright section, it's going to be painful seeing these guys leave. That is the reality of it. It's not going to be great. And if they brought in 7, 8, 9 new players, you're by no means guaranteed they're all going to come off. A lot of them are going to be, because we know the profile of player that Palace tend to target now, a lot of them are going to be young, they're going to be raw, they're going to be players of talent, but of a potential as opposed to pedigree. So we're going to have to give them a bit of time to settle, which means that the start of next season might be difficult. It might be. I mean, that's the reality of it. But I mean, at the start of this season, that Bournemouth was bloody difficult, and then they took off. You've got to hope that happens again. Furthermore, Oliver Glasner may look at the squad and decide that even some of these star players aren't what he needs to make his football work. That's a possibility. In which case, he might not be as distraught to lose one of those guys, or two or three of those guys potentially, if he can bring in players that he feels he can mould into a better team and a team that can play his style. So I think it's going to be a lot of upheaval, and it's going to be quite exciting to watch how it all unfolds. And we're going to need an awful lot of patience and an awful lot of faith that the decisions that are being made, there's a logic to them, and they're all working on singing from the same hymn book towards the same objective. There are going to be periods where we go through weeks and nobody signs, and the panic will set in like it always does, and the fan base will be up in arms, and the podcasts that we do will be, oh my god, it's all gone mad and it's all gone wrong. But ultimately, if we have a scenario similar to 2021, but with probably more arrivals and fewer departures, then we can be in a better place next season in terms of the squad depth, and which will have knock-on effects. We won't, fingers crossed, have as many injuries. We won't be putting the same amount of strain on the same small group of players. And that can lead to a very successful season, fingers crossed, under Oliver Glasner. But it's going to be one of those ones where nothing's going to be instant. We might sign a Jefferson Lerma type player very, very early, as in a free transfer, and everybody thinks, yes, things are moving. And then you might go a month where nothing happens, and then five players might join. It's going to be one of those. We're just going to have to accept that's the way it is. A situation complicated by a Copa America and a European Championships, which are going to get in the way as well.
And those bloody Olympics as well, Dom.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, yeah.
Joke, if extend any of those points or take any point you want, but just to kind of throw into the mix of all of that, some degree of uncertainty still surrounding the sporting director's future as well. Although less so than there was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yes, the certainly the paper talk has quietened on that, and there are other names that have been a bit louder.
Online outlets are also available.
Yes, in terms of who Manchester United would be interested in bringing into the team. Should he stay? I have pretty good faith in the players that we would be trying to get. having being cash rich, if you like, because of the assumed sales and also the loan to have that money to play with now. It reminds me a bit, Dom talking about this actually being quite common practice. I remember the sale of Aaron Wan-Bissaka was shortly followed by a loan agreement with an Australian bank, I think it was, who essentially for the fee of $3 or $4 million were able to give Palace the presumably Manchester United's deal was going to be this set amount every year, but Palace were able to get the money up front via a loan agreement, and probably led to the spend on someone like Eze coming in, actually. I mean, if I've got my timings right there. We may have another summer like the Vieira summer with regards to maybe being able to get players over the line just by having the right money at the right time. It won't always be easy, though. I think there's going to be lots of players we'll be linked with that we just won't get because of the unset. It's weird with these alleged release clauses of the bigger players and that certainly those that have signed new deals, Ebbs, Michael Olise. There's a knowledge that, if someone wants them enough, I think they'll pay these fees because they're slightly less than the perceived value if they weren't there. But it's just about the timing of you then don't know, you might not know when that's going to come in. A club might leave it really late to decide to just skip negotiations and go straight to that. I guess in an ideal world, you'd want that all to happen quite early in the window, but you can't. You think at summer, there's very few Premier League clubs that actually do their business really early in the summer. I think Liverpool did pretty well early into the summer last year, but it's not that common. So I think
The PSR thing, though, Joe. I mean, because a lot of the clubs will be up against it. I mean, there are a lot of rumours floating around. Palace, I don't think Palace are one of them, but there are a lot of rumours floating around about, you know, 7-8 clubs on being close to the limit in terms of the current PSR rules, and bearing in mind that those PSR rules will change at some point, and I don't know when that will happen. No one knows when that's for certain when that will happen, and a different percentage of your revenues, etc., and all the algorithms and ridiculous formula that they come up with. But if that's the case, then who's going to spend money up to June the 30th? And the reality is, you say there that Liverpool spent money. I think one or two did, yeah. But they stand out because no one does.
No one does it, yeah.
Yeah, it's just not... From July the 1st, they can start spending the next year's, you know, financial figures money. So I suspect there'll be the usual rush of stuff, but Palace have at least given themselves a bit of leeway. Maybe they will be one of the clubs that is active early, relatively active early. But again, we have to go back. We look back now through rose-tinted spectacles at 2021,
and they arrived quite late, didn't they?
They did. That was not a stress-free summer. I mean, the managerial situation itself was
managed to come until the 5th of July. Yeah,
it was real problem. I remember a lot of the podcasts we did that summer was like very doom and gloom as to what's going on here.
I think Anderson was on the bench for the first game because he arrived late into that.
Well, that team we put out at Chelsea in that first game was barely recognisable, was it? I mean, it was ridiculous. Bad. But I mean, that's another, and it may be that's what happens again, because even with a loan coming in and even with sales, Palace operate in a certain way in the market because they have to squeeze as much quality as they possibly can for the amount of funds that they've got. So if the perception is that you can get more of a bargain nearer the transfer deadline, then that's what Palace will have to do. But you just like to hope that if they're sort of assuming that at least two of those three players are leaving, at least two of them are going, then you make sure you've got replacements for those two in place as close as you possibly can. Because we're not going to get, you know, an England international like Ebbs or an England international like Marc Guéhi or a potential France international like Olise just walking straight into our team and hitting the ground running, because those players cost you about similar sort of money as we'll get for those. I mean, it's
like
logically. Yeah, exactly. And we won't want to do that. That's not the model. The model is to try and make us as self-sufficient as we possibly can in a division that is completely warped and that you can't compete with half the clubs in the division because they're just backed by a lot more money and have a lot more income and and, you know, marketing revenues and merchandise, everything. It's just it's not a level playing field.
I'd be stunned if we broke the transfer record again. Let's say two or three big sales came in. I would be really surprised if that Benteke fee or perhaps even the next one down were under any threat, because I just think if we're signing players for that much money, it just defeats the whole object of the approach of the model, because it's highly unlikely we're going to be able to flip players for a worthwhile profit we're already going in that high.
I wonder what the expectation of the manager will be, though, given that he signed only a 2.5-year contract. I know there's an option for a third year on that. He's going to want to be competitive next season.
Yeah,
he will be, but I just wonder with that £30 million, what does £30 million get you in the current market? And Dom, I wanted to ask you the question, and I recall the excellent podcast you did with Rafa Honigstein on The Athletic. With the new manager coming, with the background he's got, would you anticipate Palace still fishing in the same pond in terms of the Championship, or do you think we will go more continental with having an Austrian manager in the dugout?
Look, our scouting department will know much better than me about the quality in the Championship, but it looks to me as if there are basically three Premier League teams plus Ipswich in the Championship. And, I mean, look, one of those might not come up. Say, for example, Leicester get a points deduction or implode as you know, is threatening to happen at the moment. How many of those Leicester players fit the Crystal Palace model, given that a club that knew that they were in financial trouble in January felt they could reject a £35 million bid for Dewsbury Hall in January? I mean, it doesn't...
The arrogance of it is quite something, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, look at them. There's a lot of quality in that Leicester side, absolutely a lot of quality. And there are some decent young kids in there, but they're going to want big fees for them. And unless there's a complete and utter fire sale, I can't see you necessarily taking a lot of those players as any Premier League club, just getting them on the cheap.
And I can't see it, but if Leeds were to fall off the road right now, and I genuinely can't see it because they're playing so well, I guess the likes of Somerville, Nonto, again, would be repeated as they were last summer. But we won't be the only club dining at that table. But
and
I just wonder if there's... We've looked at those previously, and I guess the hope would be there'd be players that have developed this season. I don't want to repeat a reference to Morgan Whittaker at Plymouth, but he's the type of player that I guess has emerged this season in a team that is at the wrong end of the Championship table. Jordan James, I think you mentioned last time, Joe, but if I've got his name right,
Birmingham City. Birmingham, he's
done well, yeah. So there are players that are emerging maybe at the lower end of the table, but you are right, Don, the top of that Championship table is effectively Premier League light now. It's not even competitive. Even two teams at the bottom end of the playoff run, they're not really in the same conversation as the top four right now.
No, not at all. And you wouldn't... I mean, I've watched quite a bit of West Brom. My next-door neighbour's a West Brom fan, and you look at their squad, and there isn't really a player you think, well, yeah, he would definitely fit in at ours. It just isn't. There's a sort of mixture of journeymen who are very used to Championship promotion races and a few players that haven't really cut it at the top level. You know, fair play, they could go up, but, you know, it's just not what we'd be going for. I think you're right, and people like, you know, picking off players from the lower reaches, and Birmingham City might go down, and so you might be taking a League One player from them, potentially, but, I mean, it's... You shop in that market with a certain level of reality. Michael Olise was a complete freak in terms of the price that he was available for, and Palace saw potential, and he's absolutely torn it up when he's been fit and available for Palace. He's been brilliant from day one. You just looked at him and thought, oh, he's got something. He's really got something. He's going places, etc. But there are not many players that you sort of pluck from the Championship that you put them into an established Premier League team, albeit a learned table one, and think, yeah, he's just going to take this. Certainly not that. Not £7 million. No. Adam Wharton costs almost £20 million,
and
he's done very, very well, and he looks as if he could be one. But that's £20 million. So £20 million might be the sort of area that you're looking at for the Championship, realistically, if you're gonna add players from there. I don't think you're gonna get many who have, you know, get out or buy out clauses in their deals that are comparable to Elise's. And then, yeah, then you're looking abroad. And where do Palace know that there's talent? They know about Germany. They know about France. And I think they probably got a lot of potential candidates in those countries that they feel as if they can mold into something special in a Premier League environment and sell on a profit, or certainly develop their talent so that they might be available for more money. Those are where you might find the occasional bargains. But again, you're looking at players that probably, you know, you might watch them now and think, God, he's atrocious today, but last week he was amazing. It's that type of thing. I mean, and a lot of them might be schooled in the sort of Red Bull model, somewhere played in that structure, and therefore fit with what Glasner might want to do with them. That's maybe where the connections are, whether it's Salzburg, whether it's Leipzig. You know, it's players that have got that ability to press energy, press, plus the quality to thrive in the Premier League. But you know, they're not all going to come off. And likewise, Palace are going to have to pay proper money for a lot of them. And that may well be 20 million. I agree with Joe. I don't think they're going to break the £30 million barrier very often, because that, unless you've got an absolutely exceptional talent that you know is going to move for 60, 70 million pounds in a couple of years' time. Mm-hmm. And that's very rare. That's patently not what they did with Benteke. That was a different era. But they're going to have to be some bargains thrown in around there as well. They're going to have to be a few free transfers, a few players just to bolster the squad. And, you know, to echo Selzy's comment, they will need that. They will need those extra players to bolster numbers. Players who maybe were a bit more ready to play in a Glasner system from the get-go, as opposed to needing to sort of adjust to new surroundings in the Premier League and the pace of the Premier League and life in a new country potentially. It's got to be a balanced and a blend of all these things.
It's going to be an interesting one. He's just got to get there. He's got to get that pre-season, Glasner. I think that's the key. When he got appointed, we all said it, and hopefully it still indicates that he's adapted well to the league. Obviously, there was the bitter blow against Luton, but let's come on to the Forest game, because that does present itself an opportunity for additional points. However, we've had a question from Harry Billum, who asks, how do you think the 4-point deduction for Forest will affect them on the eve of our match versus them? Is it a positive or negative thing? Ever the pessimist, I think it's an awful thing for Palace that Forest have had those points deducted, and I'm absolutely petrified of this Saturday. Joe, how are you feeling?
Given the atmosphere I experienced up there last season, yeah. It's not the most welcome ground for a team to arrive to, not least when there's some angst, that something to get angry about from a Forest perspective. So it's not the ideal game. It's probably the last one of the last I would have picked outside of the big five or six in the Premier League. But they're not. They're not in the best form. They're even under the new manager, they've got the odd plum result. But they are a team I think we can get at, even if we haven't actually. That we've had a positive result against them since they've come back up. I think it's been all draws and a defeat at the City Ground.
Two draws at Selhurst and the defeat last November. Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously
two Novembers ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, the home draw this season comes with a big context of. Just we had nobody on the pitch. It was actually a very good point in the end, but yes, not actually a fixture I'm looking forward to, and not the stadium to arrive back into after a break like that. But I think on our day we it was more than good enough to give them a match and a game and maybe take the points off them. It's just who are we going to be able to put on that pitch and. How ready are they for an atmosphere like that? Because, yeah, there is a pending appeal. I think Forest are going to hear, they're going to be heard in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
But that's not going to cool their ire anymore, is it? It's not. They're still going to be spicy.
I'm somewhat hopeful that Palace can ice the red-hot atmosphere as Alejandro Garnacho did at Goodison when Everton got awarded their point deduction by scoring an absolute worldie within the first 10 minutes. But Dom, it is a decision that Forest fans will have been expecting. I think the club have been very open and seemingly quite open with the investigation into it. But you would still expect the fans to respond with what you would only describe as a febrile atmosphere come 2:55 on Saturday afternoon.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you look at the results that they've had of late, they'll have targeted this game for ages as a chance to...
Regardless of the point deduction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's not... I'm just looking at their running now. I mean, actually, they've got Sheffield United and Burnley away still to play, which they'll be looking at eyeing up with... that's two of their last three games. And a rather inconsistent Chelsea in between them as well at home at the City Ground. So they will still think and believe that they can get out of trouble, particularly if their appeal is successful and that 4 point becomes three or two, which there has to be a possibility of. Although actually the consensus of things is that they actually got away quite easily with four, from the outside looking in anyway. So it's... Anyway, that's by the by. That's to be determined, and that you know the season is going to be played out to an asterisk for a long time yet. It's just a game Palace cannot afford to lose. They must not lose this match. And I draw some encouragement. I know Palace's away form has been pretty desperate for a while, but they did put in an excellent performance for and a rugged and real fighting performance at Everton.
Mm.
Two games ago away from home. And if they can emulate that with Glasner was watching on from that and that evening at Goodison against a team of a similar level in Forest, then you know a point would be a good result, I think. We just got to keep them at arm's length, just keep them away. A defeat for Palace wouldn't have alarm bells ringing, but it's you look at the difficulty of Palace's running, certainly compared to that of Forest, and you think, oof. Yeah, you don't want to be giving them 3 points now and giving them that little chance to haul you back in.
There was one other piece of news from the trip to Spain, and that was the listener will not be surprised, hamstring injury again, ring the bell, Olsen Edward. I don't think there's an expectation that it's the worst, but it's quite possible we'll be going into this weekend minus a player that we were having available to us before the end of the season. Before the end of the Luton game. So I think Michael Olise might still not be available. Mark Gay, still not available. And we've added an injury. Despite the positives of that break, we are going to have won this.
Jeff's back.
Jeff Schlupp is back. That is true. And we will leave it there with in terms of Jeff before we get accused of... Yeah. Jim put the 3-2-1 stats up. As kind of an indication to anyone that doesn't listen as to where we are. And the only comments that were there was, when did Jeffrey Schlupp get points? When did Jeffrey Schlupp get points? So there was no comment about the top of the charts. It was it was about Jeff Schlupp getting 5 points. But
I think that probably would have been Burnley away from memory.
Burnley away when he scored a goal.
Yeah.
Pretty sure I voted for him. Sorry. I love Jeff. Leave him alone. Yes. He's with me.
He's back in Dom's happy.
And he's going to be needed between now and the end of the season.
Too right.
Sure.
Let's not make a mistake. And I think another player was... I know he certainly travelled, but I didn't hear many updates, so I guess perhaps we'll hear his name again in the Friday press conference. Jesrak Seki, I believe, is another week or 2 weeks closer to maybe being in contention, which Austin Edward is a striker. But we often have to deploy him elsewhere or at least try and get him on the pitch by any means necessary due to some of the absences we've had. And another winger that's fit at the moment is going to be very useful, particularly if Jordan Ayew has to go to the other side of the pitch. And my concern is more that we have one striker on the one fit striker in Jean-Philippe Mateta.
He's top of the 3-2-1 charts, Joe. Don't you worry about that, mate.
He is, but if his legs start to go towards the end of a game, is Oliver Glasner going to bring on Luke Plange for the last 10 minutes?
He can't.
Sure. He's gone, he's left.
He can't.
Oh, is he gone? Of course he's gone to HKK, isn't he?
Yeah.
So
you should tune in to International Clearance, a podcast about English players abroad, Joe.
You're right. You're very right. It doesn't even got a mention on it. So who becomes now the next... Who's the next level down of Palace striker?
James Tompkins.
Oh, I see.
Go long.
Jesse Derry can't be far away at this point.
Hey, there's another international call up we didn't touch on.
Yes, yeah.
So, congratulations to the Derry family. So, I mean, we've got Forest, and you both talked about the importance there to not lose. We probably should mention, because I don't think we will get a midweek pod in before we travel down to Dorset. Bournemouth, equally so, but maybe a little bit more of an open game, perhaps not as febrile an atmosphere. I'm making the trip down for that one. I'm looking forward to that. Any expectations for that, or is your thinking about that game going to be fully influenced by what happens on Saturday?
Well, it can't be any worse than the home game against them. I the famous last words, but I think the approach that we would take to that game as the away side might actually be more positive than what we were able to deliver in that Selhurst fixture. It was just, that was the first, the loudest alarm bell that we'd had in the season so far. And we never truly recovered from that, I think, fan base wise, in terms of their faith towards, support towards Roy. So I think we're going to be better than that. Whether that's going to be enough to get points is a different matter. We're overdue something there, aren't we? Am I thinking?
We've got a fairly good record there, I think. Won last year 2-0.
We did win there last year 2-0.
Yeah. One of the COVID time. In 2021.
Yeah.
COVID 2020, rather.
Yeah. I actually don't remember too many bad trips down. I remember losing on a Monday night to
2-1.
Amadou Sakho losing the plot and handballing in the last minute or something.
Yes. I think it might be in my head. I think they're a side that I always look to and think, well, that's the team. We should be getting points off them this season.
Yeah, yeah.
And perhaps any time we don't, it sticks in the mind. Yeah.
Two massive games. No, as you say, there are fixtures into April where there is hope we can pick up points, but it would be a lot better for all of us if we can go into those games with some points from these.
You don't want to go into Man City and Liverpool having lost those two, do you?
I'm not even looking at those two.
They're the next two games.
They are the one. Maybe we'll have a few more question specials. Not talking about actual matches in the middle of April. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining for this one. It's been lovely to have a chat without having a performance to dissect. And hopefully, listener, we've addressed a few of the topics that maybe you'd have hoped would have done over the last few months. But obviously, with events, we haven't done. We are back in the normal swing of things next week. A post-match pod dropping after Forest. Perhaps a dedicated salesy pod. He has his own day now. And then a midweek pod hitting your feed next week, but to be confirmed as to whether that will be before or after Bournemouth. I suspect maybe after the Bournemouth game, in which case patrons will get another post-match pod after that one, and maybe another salesy day. Who knows? Every day's a salesy day. Who knows? We will see. But for patrons, those will be dropped. If you aren't a patron and would like to support the podcast, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/FYP podcast. Final thing to add is a final thanks to both of you. And listener, we will be back soon. Hope you've enjoyed this listener special. So thanks for tuning in and go well.
Podcast Network.